welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. Why do we continue to find mysteries about amateur sleuths, private eyes, and cops so arresting? I would argue the appeal lies in the fact these folks do what many of us wish we could: confront authority, triumph over impossible odds, and right wrongs. I think you'll find today's show an entertaining mix of characters old and new. We'll preview hot-off-the-press titles from popular authors and introduce new writers who add their own special spin to the genre. Sarah Paretsky returns to the Book Report to fill us in on the latest in her popular V.I. Warshawski series. V.I.'s a great gal and a private eye with a heart of gold and a knack for trouble. Ready to start the case? Let's turn now to page one of the Book Report. Artemis Black is the perennially down-on-his-luck Hollywood P.I. whose bogey fixation is as dated as his wardrobe. With an assistant who mocks him relentlessly, a romantic life that's deader than Elvis, money problems, booze, nicotine, and anger management issues, how much worse can it get? Well, let's find out in Black, book one in Russell Blake's detective mystery series, With a Difference. Black takes a case that's supposed to be easy money. He's working for a celebrity whose colleagues and surrounding paparazzi are dropping faster than interest in the star's big comeback. The cakewalk turns ugly, and Black finds himself in a web of deceit, betrayal, and murder. And bad hair days. R.C. Bray performs the book.
A harsh wind tore at the scrub along the edge of the rural road, the gusts assaulting the hills with startling ferocity. Electricity crackled across the elephant hide sky as the Ford Econoline's tires shrieked in smoking alarm. The heavy vehicle lumbered around a hairpin turn, far in excess of any sane speed, engine roaring as it labored toward the summit. The Ferrari California 30 convertible ahead of it negotiated the curves like an Olympic skier, its red taillights winking at the van like a taunt, the deceptive twists a slim challenge for its driver, even after more than a few drinks. It was late afternoon, and a front had moved in, one of the freak storms that could come out of nowhere and disrupt the late spring warmth that was the birthright of Southern California's privileged. Flashes of light pulsed within the blanket of dark clouds brooding over the hills, threatening a downpour at any moment. But for now, the heavens growling was the harmless protest of a caged bear. Another curve, another screeching drift as tortured rubber fought to grip the asphalt, and the huge motor propelled the cargo vehicle closer to its elusive quarry. Inside, a hirsute young man with 2 days' growth dusting his swarthy features gripped the black lens of a Canon EOS 5D camera and gritted his teeth as the driver gave the van everything he had, pushing the ungainly conveyance to its limits.
"Damn, slow down, would you? It's not worth getting us killed," he complained.
"Relax, Omar, I've got it under control," the driver snarled, his furrowed brow betraying the lie in his assurance.
An old Chevrolet pickup truck swung around the bend and narrowly missed the van's front fender, causing them to lose a few precious seconds as the Italian car pulled over the rise and began its descent down Malibu Canyon Road, the sheer drop to the rocks hundreds of feet below a slim deterrent to its increasing speed.
"We're DOA if we can't catch up," Omar said. "DOA pays lousy."
"I intend to get paid," the driver muttered, and tromped on the gas as the Ferrari disappeared from view around another curve.
The Ferrari driver wiped her face with the palm of her hand and shifted into third gear, increasing the engine revs to buy traction as she crested the summit. The clouds roiling over the ocean pulled her attention toward the water, a slate mirror stretching to the horizon, calm, before the heavens let loose. Snoop Dogg's hypnotic atonal delivery wove its serpentine spell over a booming bass groove pulsing from the stereo, and after twisting the volume louder, she tapped her fingers on the steering wheel in time with the rap beat. She glanced at the van in her rearview mirror and allowed herself a small smirk before her eyes drifted back to the road. Another hairpin was coming up,
one she knew well from having almost lost it there the last time she'd had a few too many at one of her valley hangouts, and she downshifted with a sloppy stab at the transmission paddle. The high-performance 8-cylinder thoroughbred racing machine whined as the RPMs hit the ceiling, the tachometer needle pegging into the red. And then the car began to gradually but reluctantly fight gravity, enough so that she could keep it mostly in her lane. A rush of adrenaline surged through her system as she guided the vehicle along a knife's edge, the painted divider line the only thing between her and oblivion, her dilated pupils taking in the panoramic tableau of Malibu laid out before her. Her stomach seemed to float for a brief second, as it did on the first drop of a roller coaster. And then her eyes saucered as she saw her future approach from around the treacherous turn, offering no time to react. Omar's face blanched as they picked up speed, and he noticed the Italian car's brake lights remained dark as it headed for one of the dead man's curves on the drop to sea level.
"Come on, man, be careful. She's whacked out of her mind. No way should she be moving that fast on this stretch," he said,
trying to steady the camera's telephoto lens and get some shots of the car hurtling at breakneck speed in front of them.
"Maybe she'll get it wrong, and we'll have an exclusive on the biggest story of the month," the driver said, an ugly grin twisting his features. "You getting anything?"
"We're bouncing around too much. Holy, look out!"
That was Black by Russell Blake. Pretty Girls is Karen Slaughter's new standalone novel. With a missing girl in the news, Claire Scott can't help but be reminded of her sister, who disappeared 20 years earlier in a case that was never solved. Claire sets out to learn the truth about her sister, but when she does, she learns nothing will ever be the same. Jennifer Woodward and Robert Slade narrate.
Lydia Delgado stared out at the sea of teenage cheerleaders on the gym floor and said a silent prayer of thanks that her daughter was not one of them. Not that she had a thing against cheerleaders. She was 41 years old. Her days of hating cheerleaders were well over. Now she just hated their mothers. "Lydia Delgado!" Mindy Parker always greeted everyone by their first and last names with a triumphant lilt at the end. "See how smart I am for knowing everyone's full name!" "Mindy Parker," Lydia said, her tone several octaves lower. She couldn't help it. She'd always been contrary. "First game of the season! I think our girls really have a chance this year." "Absolutely," Lydia agreed, though everyone knew it was going to be a massacre. "Anyway," Mindy straightened out her left leg, raised her arms over her head, and stretched toward her toes. "I need to get Dee's signed permission slip." Lydia caught herself before she asked, "What permission slip?" "I'll have it for you tomorrow." "Fantastic!" Mindy hissed out an overly generous stream of air as she came out of the stretch. With her pursed lips and pronounced underbite, she reminded Lydia of a frustrated French bulldog. "You know, we never want Dee to feel left out. We're so proud of our scholarship students." "Thank you, Mindy," Lydia plastered on a smile. "It's sad that she had to be smart to get into Westerly instead of just having a lot of money." Mindy plastered on her own smile. "Okay, well, cool beans. I'll look for that permission slip in the morning." She squeezed Lydia's shoulder as she bounced up the bleachers toward the other mothers, or capital M mothers, as Lydia thought of them, because she was trying really hard not to use the word anymore. Lydia scanned the basketball court for her daughter. She had a moment of panic that nearly stopped her heart, but then she spotted Dee standing in the corner. She was talking to Bella Wilson, her best friend, as they bounced a basketball back and forth between them. Was this young woman really her daughter? 2 seconds ago, Lydia had been changing her diapers, and then she had turned her head for just a moment, and when she looked back, Dee was 17 years old. She would be heading off to college in less than 10 months. To Lydia's horror, she'd already started packing. The suitcase in Dee's closet was so full that the zipper wouldn't close all the way. Lydia blinked away tears because it wasn't normal for a grown woman to cry over a suitcase. Instead, she thought about the permission slip that Dee had not given her. The team was probably going to a special dinner that Dee was afraid Lydia couldn't afford. Her daughter did not understand that they were not poor. Yes, they had struggled early on as Lydia tried to get her dog grooming business off the ground, but they were solidly middle class now, which was more than most people could say. They just weren't westerly wealthy. Most Westerly Academy parents could easily afford the $30,000 a year to send their kid to private school. They could ski at Tahoe over Christmas or charter private planes down to the Caribbean. But even though Lydia could never provide the same for Dee, she could pay for her daughter to go to Chops and order a steak. She would, of course, find a less hostile way to convey this to her child. Lydia reached into her purse and pulled out a bag of potato chips. The salt and grease provided an instant rush of comfort, like letting a couple of Xanax melt under your tongue. She had told herself when she put on her sweatpants this morning that she was going to the gym, and she had gone near the gym, but only because there was a Starbucks in the parking lot.
We've just heard Pretty Girls by Karen Slaughter. Paretsky revolutionized the mystery world in 1982 with her introduction of Private Eye V.I. Warshawski. Tough, credible, street smart, and feminine, V.I. challenged the stereotypes of women in fiction as victims or vamps. In creating her, Sarah opened the door for a new generation of crime writers. V.I. reflects Sarah's own ardor for social justice. Sarah came to Chicago from her native Kansas in 1966 to work as a community organizer during the turbulent civil rights era. Sarah served with then State Senator Obama, serving Chicago's emotionally challenged homeless. She's mentored teens in Chicago's most troubled schools and works closely with literacy and reproductive rights groups. In the literary world, Sarah created Sisters in Crime in 1986, an international organization that supports women crime writers. She's received numerous awards and honors, including being named a Grandmaster by the Mystery Writers of America. She now serves as that organization's president. Sarah's memoir, Writing in an Age of Silence, was a National Book Critics Circle finalist. In 2012, to celebrate the 30th anniversary of the V.I. series, Mayor Rahm Emanuel declared March 14th in Chicago as Sarah Paretsky Day. Today, we'll speak with Sarah about her newest V.I. mystery, Brushback. Sarah, it's great to have you back with us on the Book Report.
Well, it's good to be here, Elaine. Thanks.
Why the title Brushback?
The book is actually, it's not really a book about baseball, but it's a book that started with my desire to set a chase scene under the stands at Wrigley Field in Chicago. And so baseball is kind of on everyone's mind in the book, and Brushback, that's when a pitcher tries to move a batter away from the plate, and it's also in the novel are a lot of people from major international gangsters to some local politicians who keep trying to brush V.I. away from the case.
You know, V.I. gets into trouble pretty quickly in this book. Can you tell us a little about that trouble?
V.I. Comes from a really kind of hardscrabble neighborhood. She grew up under the shadow of the old steel mills, which have rusted into oblivion in Chicago. Her mother died when she was 16, and her first boyfriend, who kind of got her through the weeks after her mother died, he hasn't had a happy life. And Frank comes to see her one day. His mother spent 25 years in prison for killing his younger sister. His mother wants exoneration, and Frank, I won't say that he blackmails V.I. into helping out, but he does remind her that he was there for her when she needed him most, and he needs her now. And FBI, she's tough as nails in some ways, but she really is a sucker for a hard luck story, and so she grumbles, but she says yes.
Well, she does have a heart of gold. You know, Chicago has always been so central in all of your books. At this point in your career, could you conceive of setting another locale?
It's funny that you should say that, because I grew up in rural Kansas. Gosh, rural is the hardest word in the English language to say. But the book that I have just started writing, the plot line is something that happens back in that part of Kansas where I grew up. And I am going to send VI there, and I don't know whether that will work or not. And it's a very tricky thing to have someone who knows how to operate in a big city, and a city with a lot of corruption and interconnection, and send her to a small town. And what will happen, it's anybody's guess. I don't know yet myself.
You know, the south side of Chicago is legendary. For those who've never been there, do you ever foresee it changing?
Things change suddenly in ways that you don't expect. The south side of Chicago, the southeast side, where the steel mills used to be, it's a very difficult life for people there now. There's been 40% unemployment since the mills shut down, and a lot of gang activity, a lot of new gangs moving into the area. It's not a place I personally feel safe going these days. I used to go down there a lot to do on-location research, and the last time I was there, I was very nearly jumped and seriously injured by some gangbangers. So I kind of back away right now. But suddenly, the land where the U.S. Steelworks used to be, the biggest steel plant in the United States, it's suddenly being turned into parkland. There's a new road going through there. There's a lot of talk about everything from big shopping malls to some kind of really good amusement park. And so there could be a sudden dramatic turnaround down there. It's an exciting time, and I hope that we do see some positive change down there.
You wrote in the book about the Uzbeki mob and the Insane Dragons. Are these actual mobs?
I made up the Uzbeki mob. I was going to use the Ukrainian mob, but I have a cousin who's in the Peace Corps in Ukraine, and I thought, gosh, the poor Ukrainians, they're really suffering right now. So I decided to spare them. The Ukrainian mob is a very scary thing. It's like the Russian mob. It's all old KGB guys who, if you are being hacked and you find that you've got Russian or Ukrainian mobsters hacking you, just back away. Don't challenge them, because they will come after you. So in real life, they're very scary, but in my fictional universe, I gave the Ukrainians a pass.
And what about the Insane Dragons?
The Insane Dragons, in fact, is a real street gang. They're getting more and more bizarre names. I think they're the Insane Vice Lords. I think it's a reflection of their feeling that they're beyond control. They're so bad, they're insane. And I realized that I should have made up names for my street gangs. I had a very good imaginary street gang in a couple of my books, and I should just go back to that.
We're speaking with Sarah Paretsky on The Book Report. You know, I'm going to quote V.I. here. She says, "In my own lifetime, 4 Illinois governors have gone to prison for fraud, the mayor of Cicero, numerous Cook County judges, plus state and federal representatives." While this makes for incredibly rich fodder for V.I., do you think Illinois leads the nation in this kind of crime at the top?
When I first moved here, the legendary columnist Mike Royko had an informal competition between the state of New Jersey and the city of Chicago as to who would have more elected officials under federal indictment at the end of the year, and New Jersey won by 1.
Oh. Well, that's something you'd like to lose. Is there improvement, or is it still as bad as that?
I think that there are things that are better. There are more effective watchdog groups, but it still is a state where the call it here is pay to play. That who you pay off is who gets the power. And there's not a lot of there's not a lot of law. And there's not a lot of muscle behind the law to stop that. I don't think it's unique to Illinois, though. I mean, when I look at the way that members of Congress are bought and sold, then I just think we have a serious problem up and down the political spectrum in America.
Yes. Well, VI has been one of crime's leading ladies for 17 books and 30 years. How has she evolved?
When I started the series, she was the first or one of the first independent investigators, both on the page and in real life. It just wasn't a job that women undertook back in the day. Ooh, I hate that phrase. Why did I use it? But so she came to the page with a chip on her shoulder about proving that she had a right to be there, had a right to be doing the job. That landscape has changed so dramatically. You know, we have so many women doing professional jobs that didn't exist for people of my generation when we were growing up, on the Supreme Court, secretaries of state, all of these things, and women police officers, women investigators. So anytime I read a new novel where a woman is kind of saying, you know, well, I'm a woman, I can do this job as well as a man, I think you're not paying attention to what's happening in the world around you. We don't have to, we've won that war. There are battles that we still have to win, but nobody questions our right to be there doing the job.
If you could go back into the early books and change one thing about VI, what would that be?
I think I would have at least one, if not both, of her parents still alive. I think when I started the series, I was so nervous about whether I could actually write a book and do the job that I pretty slavishly followed the conventions of the form. And, you know, people like Sam Spade or Philip Marlowe, they're just such loners. They're painfully alone. And so I did like they did. I made my poor detective an orphan. And I think it would make for a richer, more interesting dynamic if she had to deal with her family.
You know, I have to ask, you worked with Obama in his early days. How do you think history will judge his presidency?
I think that I don't think Barack is a great politician. I think he's a little aloof, a little too maybe intellectual. But I also think he's had a much more successful presidency than he's given credit for, both by the public and certainly by news outlets. You know, without the stimulus that he provided when he first came into office, I'm convinced we would have had a depression equal to the 30s. We have a very flawed health care program, but we have one now. There wasn't one before. The GM bailout was crucial. So I think history's going to look at him and say, this is a guy who dealt with a Congress that publicly stated at every opportunity that their only agenda was to keep him from ever passing a bill, and yet he's been able to do a lot.
I agree with you. Any final thoughts about Brushback?
Well, the thing that got the book in motion for me, as I said, was the chase scene under Wrigley Field, and I tried hard to get the Cubs to let me actually to go in and see the stands, what's underneath the stands. I'd been told that when the stadium was built in the 1920s, that it's just kind of a mess underneath, and toilets hadn't been flushed for 60 years and so on. I never could get in to see it. They wouldn't return my phone calls or my emails. So I got to make it all up, and I had a lot of fun with that.
Well, it certainly was a lot of fun, and I'm wondering why you didn't get the mayor to get on their case, but okay.
Yeah, little Rom.
Yeah.
He's a little dynamo.
Yeah. Well, Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today. I loved the book. It gets two thumbs way up. Thank you.
Thank you, Elaine. Great to talk to you again.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And now, let's listen to a sampling of Brushback, performed by Karen Peaks.
Frank had left me for Betty Pokorny when we were all in high school. Her father had owned day and night bar and grill. When the mills were running three shifts, no matter what time you got off or went on, you could get steak and eggs with a boilermaker. When Betty started smirking at me in the high school hallway, I'd been heartbroken for a few weeks. But my dad told me that Frank wasn't right for me, that I was looking for love in all the wrong places because Gabriella had died a few months earlier. He'd been right. It had been years since I'd thought about either Frank or Betty. Looking at Frank this morning, in his ill-fitting jacket and uneasy fidgeting, he seemed vulnerable and needy. Let him imagine that hearing about Betty could cause me a pang or two. "How are Betty's folks?" I asked. "Her ma passed a few years back, but her dad is still going strong, even without the bar. You know, they had to shut that down." "Someone told me," I said. Day and night had followed the mills into extinction. But by then, I was so far removed from the neighborhood that I hadn't even felt schadenfreude, only a vague pity for Frank. "Her dad, he keeps busy. He's handy with tools, builds stuff, keeps the house from falling over. I guess you don't know we moved in with him when, well, you know, when they got married, I guessed. Or maybe when Stella went to prison. What did you do about your place on Buffalo?" "Ma kept it. My dad's insurance or something let her make the payments while she was in Logan. I looked in on it once a week, made sure nothing was leaking or burning, kept the rats and the gangbangers from moving in. Ma says she owns it clear and free now." "She's out?" I blurted.
"Yeah, 2 months ago."
His heavy shoulders sagged, further stressing the shoulders in the jacket. Annie Guzzo had been 3 years younger than me, and I was finishing my junior year of college when she died. I counted in my head. I guess it had been 25 years. South Chicago was a neighborhood where violence was routine, ordinary. Stella Guzzo had grown up in a hard-scrabble house herself, and shouting and hitting were her main modes of functioning. We all knew she hit her daughter, but what turned people's stomachs was that Stella had beaten Annie to death and then walked up to St. Eloy's to play bingo. Not even my Aunt Marie, Stella's chief crony, stood up for her.
"I never made those marks on my girl," Stella protested at the trial. "They're lying about me, making me look bad because I was trying to get Annie to see the facts of life. She was getting those big ideas way above herself. She didn't think she needed a vacuum or do the laundry because she was going to school, but she needed to remember she was part of a family. Everyone has to carry their weight in a family. She's got a brother. He's the one with a future, and he needs looking after. I can't do it all on my own, especially not with her father dead. But Annie was fine when I left the house."
Father Gilchowski, the priest at St. Eloy's, had testified for Stella. She was a good woman, a dedicated mother. She didn't spare the rod, but that was what made her a good mother. She didn't tolerate the rudeness a lot of modern women let their children get away with. Priests usually play well with Chicago juries, but not this time. Stella was built on massive lines, not fat, but big, like the figurehead of a Viking ship. Frank took after her, but Annie was small, like their father. The state's attorney showed pictures of Annie's battered face and the family photos where she looked like a dark little elf next to her mother's broad-shouldered 5'10". Instead of manslaughter, the state went for second-degree homicide and got it. I didn't remember the trial clearly, but I don't think the jury deliberated longer than half a day. Stella drew the full 2 dimes, with a little extra thrown in to punish her for her belligerent attitude in court. I never would be a Stella fan, but the thought of her alone in a decrepit South Chicago bungalow was disturbing. "Is she there by herself?" I asked Frank. "It's hard dealing with the outside world when you've been away from it so long. Besides that, South Chicago is a war zone these days, between the Kings and the Insane Dragons and about 5 other big gangs.
That was Brushback by Sarah Paretsky. Val McDermott from Kirkcaldy, Fife, Scotland, is one of the UK's most popular crime writers. She's published 27 novels. I'm unfamiliar with her work, but no time like the present to meet a master. In Cross and Burn, guilt and grief have driven a wedge between longtime crime-fighting partners, psychologist Tony Hill and ex-DCI Carol Jordan. But just because they're not talking doesn't mean the killing stops. Someone is killing women. Women who bear a disturbing resemblance to Carol Jordan. And when the evidence begins to point in a terrible direction, thinking the unthinkable seems the only possible answer. Saul Reichlin narrates.
Dr. Tony Hill shifted in his seat and tried to avoid looking at the wreckage of her face. When you think of Carol Jordan, what comes into your mind? Chris Devine, still formerly a detective sergeant with Bradfield Metropolitan Police, cocked her head towards him as if to compensate for a degree of deafness. When you think of Carol Jordan, what comes into your mind? Her voice had a deliberate teasing quality. He recognized it as a bid to deflect him from his line. I try not to think about Carol. In spite of his best efforts, the sadness seeped to the surface. Maybe you should. Maybe you need to go there more than I do. The room had grown dim as they talked. The day was dying outside, but the light seemed to be leaching out of the room at a faster rate. Because she couldn't see him, it was safe, for once, to let his face betray him. His expression was the opposite of the lightness of his tone. You're not my therapist, you know. And you're not mine. Unless you're here as my mate, I'm not interested. I've told them I'm not wasting my time with a counsellor. But then, you know that, don't you? They'll have told you the score. You're still their go-to guy. The rabbit they pull out of the hat when all the other magic tricks have fallen flat. It was amazing she didn't sound more bitter, he thought. In her shoes, he'd be raging, lashing out at anyone who sat still long enough. It's true. I do know you've refused to cooperate with the therapy team. But that's not why I've come. I'm not here to try and counsel you by the back door. I'm here because we've known each other for a long time. That doesn't make us friends. Her voice was dull, all animation stripped from the words. No, I don't really do friendship. It surprised him how easy it was to be candid with someone who couldn't see his face or his body language. He'd read about the phenomenon, but he'd never experienced it at first hand. Maybe he should try wearing dark glasses and feigning blindness with his more intransigent patients. She gave a dry little laugh. You do a decent facsimile when it suits you. Kind of you to say so. A long time ago, someone called it passing for human. I liked the sound of that. I've been using it ever since. That's pitching it a bit high, mate. What does the length of time we've known each other have to do with the price of fish? We're what's left, I suppose. He shifted in his chair, uncomfortable at the way the conversation was going. He'd come because he wanted to reach out, to help her. But the longer he sat here, the more he felt like he was the one who needed help. After the dust has settled, I think you're here because you hoped that no one talking to me would help you understand whatever it is you're feeling, she pointed out with a note of sharpness. Because I took the hit for her, didn't I? That's a closer bond than we ever had in all those years of working together. I thought I was the psychologist here. It was a weak response, barely a parry to her thrust. Doesn't that mean you can figure out what's going on in your own head? Your own heart, come to that. It's complicated, right, Doc? I mean, if it was only guilt, it would be easy, right? That'd make sense. But it's more than that, isn't it? Because there's a dark side to guilt. The rage. The feeling that it's just not fair. That you're the one left carrying the weight. The outrage because you're left with a sense of responsibility. That sense of injustice. It's like heartburn. Like acid burning into you. She stopped abruptly, shocked by her own figure of speech. I'm sorry. Her hand moved towards her face, stopping millimeters from the shiny red skin left by the acid booby trap that had been targeted at someone else. So, What does come into your mind when you think about Carol Jordan? She persisted, her voice harsh now. Tony shook his head. I can't say.
That was Cross and Burn by Val McDermott. X is Sue Grafton's 24th Kinsey Millhone mystery. Her millions of readers begin to live with the very real fear. What happens when we get to the end of the alphabet? X, the number 10, an unknown quantity, a mistake, a cross, a kiss. Sue Grafton's X is perhaps her darkest and most chilling novel. X, performed by Judy Kaye, features a remorseless serial killer who leaves no trace of his crimes. The test is whether Kinsey can prove her case against him before she becomes his next victim.
Stella's husband, Douglas, was the architect who designed the remodel of a condominium Ari and Teddy owned in downtown Santa Teresa. It was while he was overseeing construction that he was stricken with a fatal heart attack. Months passed. After the remodeling work was finished, Ari and Teddy continued to see Stella, who had adjusted to her widowhood as best she could, with all that money as compensation. Then came disaster. That September, Teddy spent a weekend in Los Angeles, attending a seminar at the Getty on the plein air painters. On Monday, when she arrived home, she hadn't been in the house an hour before an acquaintance rang her up and gave her a blow-by-blow. Teddy's options were limited. Fight, flight, play dead, or screw him. She'd slapped Ari with divorce papers within the week. He got the house, which she couldn't afford to maintain in any event. She got the flat in London. He got a sizable chunk of jewelry, including the necklace he'd given her for their 10th anniversary. She freely confessed she was bitter about that. The stocks and bonds had been sorted out between them. The division was fair and square, which pissed her off no end. There was nothing fair and square about a cheating husband who'd boffed her best friend. In a further cruel twist of fate, in the division of their assets, Teddy had been awarded the very condominium where the architect had breathed his last. More real estate was the last thing she needed. Her broker priced the condo at $1 million plus and assured her of a quick sale. After the apartment sat for 18 months without a nibble, Teddy decided the place would be more attractive if it were properly furnished and decorated. She'd hired a Santa Teresa stager named Annabel Wright and instructed her to cherry-pick the items in Ari's basement for that purpose. He agreed because the hostilities had gone on long enough and he wanted her out of his hair. Once the condo was suitably tarted up, Teddy had hired a photographer to do a shoot, and the resulting four-color brochure was circulated among real estate agents in Beverly Hills. A well-known actor had snapped it up, all cash, no contingencies, and a 10-day escrow. The deal was done, and all that remained was for the two of them to sign off so Teddy could collect her check. In the meantime, and this was Teddy's final rationalization, number 4, Ari and Stella had gotten married. Teddy had moved to Bel Air by then, living in the guest house of a friend who'd taken pity on her and invited her to stay for an unspecified period of time. It was during the 10-day escrow, while papers were being drawn up, that someone spotted the painting that appeared in the brochure. A seascape shone hanging above the fireplace in the living room. This was a dealer who owned a gallery on Melrose and had an unerring eye for the finer things in life. He glanced at the photograph and then brought it closer to his face. A nanosecond later, he picked up the phone and called Teddy, who'd long been a customer of his. "This looks like a Turner, darling. Could it possibly be genuine?" "Oh, I doubt it. That's been sitting in the basement for years." "Well, if I were you, I'd send color photographs to the Tate to see if someone can establish the provenance. Better yet, take the painting yourself and see what they have to say. What harm could it do?" Heeding his advice, she decided to retrieve the painting and have it examined by the experts. She returned to Santa Teresa, where she signed the final papers on the sale, and then drove from the broker's office to the condominium. She'd been told the new owner would be taking possession the following weekend, as soon as the place had been emptied. So when she let herself in, she was astonished to see the apartment had already been stripped to the bare walls. No furniture, no art, no Persian carpets, and no accessories. She'd called Ari, who was gleeful. He said he'd known she'd dash in and confiscate any items she took a fancy to, so he'd made a preemptive strike and emptied the place. If she wanted to dispute the move, she could have her attorney contact his. As she no longer had access to the painting, she approached the photographer and asked to see his proofs. There were several clear shots of the painting, which was really quite lovely now that she had the chance to examine it more closely.
That was X by Sue Grafton. After 7 national bestsellers and 8 seasons as one of TV's most successful shows, Jeff Lindsay bids farewell to his uniquely twisted and beloved serial killer, Dexter Morgan. Dexter is Dead is the definitive conclusion of the character. Dexter Morgan has burned the candle at both ends for many years. Blood spatter analyst, husband, father, serial killer. And now his world has collapsed. Dexter is arrested on charges of murder. He's lost everything. Wife, kids, and the loyalty of his sister. Completely alone, Dexter faces a murder charge for a crime, ironically, he did not commit. His only chance for freedom lies with his brother, Brian, who has a dark plan to prove Dexter's innocence. But the stakes are deadly, and the epic showdown that lies in Dexter's path may lead, once and for all, to his demise. The author narrates.
My story is simple, straightforward, and unassailable. I learned Robert was a pedophile and had taken Aster. While I looked for him, he killed Jackie. And as one final irony in our King of Fools crown derby, Rita. Helpless, hapless, hopeless Rita, queen of the scatterbrained monologue. Dear, ditzy Rita, who could not find her own car keys if they were welded to her fist. Rita found him before I did. Robert thumped her on the head, from which blow she died while Robert was busy thumping me and planning a romantic escape with his true love, Aster. While I lay bound and helpless, Aster stuck a knife in Robert, set me free, and so ended this zany madcap adventure of Doofus Dexter, Bumbler Extraordinaire. If there really is a god, which is at the very best extremely debatable, he has a terrible sense of humor. Because the detective in charge of deciphering the carnage is Detective Anderson, a man who has lived his life without making a friend of intelligence, wit, or competence. And possibly because I am so very liberally endowed with all three, and additionally because he knew me to be intimate with Miss Forrest, a thing he could only drool and dream of, Detective Anderson absolutely, without compromise, hates me. Loathes, despises, detests, and abhors the very air I breathe. And so my simple story quickly became an alibi, which is never a good thing. Even quicker, I moved from person of interest to suspect. And then, Detective Anderson took one quick glance at the crime scenes and formed a simple conclusion, undoubtedly the only kind he can form. Aha, quoth he. Dexter done it. Justice is served. Or words to that effect, probably a great deal simpler and less elegant, but in any case, resulting in my promotion from suspect to perpetrator. And I, still reeling from the death of Jackie, my ticket to a new and better life, plus the death of Rita and her entire book of delightful recipes, and the sight of Aster in a white silk negligee, still reeling, I say, from the utter destruction of all the order and certainty that was Dexter's world past, present, and future, I find myself hauled roughly to my feet, handcuffed with hands behind my back, and chained to the floor of a squad car, which drives me to Turner Guilford Knight Correctional Facility. Without a kind word or sympathetic glance from anyone, I am led, still draped with cold steel chains, inside the huge concrete barbed wire bedecked building, and into a room that looks like the waiting room of the Greyhound station in Hell. The room is full to overflowing with desperate characters, killers and rapists and thugs and gangsters all, my kind of people. But I am given no time at all to sit and consort with my fellow alleged monsters, no chance for a hail felon well met. Instead, I am hustled straight through to the next room, where I am photographed, fingerprinted, stripped, and issued a lovely orange jumpsuit. It is fashionably baggy, and the bright colors say, spring. The aroma, however, has a less cheery message, blooming somewhere between insecticide and lemon candies made from old Chinese drywall. But I am given no choice of color, nor of odor, and so I proudly wear the orange, which, after all, is one of the trademark colors of my alma mater, the University of Miami. And then, still festooned with restraints, I am brought here to my new home, the ninth floor, and deposited without ceremony in my present tidy nook.
That was Dexter is Dead by Jeff Lindsay. NFL linebacker-turned-lawyer Jake Lassiter has had it with shifty clients, dirty prosecutors, and a legal system out of whack. It's enough to make a man want to leave Miami and never look back. Until he gets a call from Victoria Lord, the better half of the hot legal team Solomon and Lord. Her partner in life and law has been arrested for murder. What's worse, the only person who can clear him has fled the city. Now it's up to Jake and Victoria to track down the witness before she's roped in by the feds or eliminated by the Russian mob. In Paul Levine's Bum Rap, Jake knows that if he doesn't get to the witness first, his client's case is lost. Luckily, he's got some good advice from his college football coach. Buckle your chin strap and hit somebody. Sometimes the only way to win a tough case is to do just that. Michael Levine narrates.
Judges. Plus, she was likable. A necessity with juries. Steve also had one talent Victoria lacked. He could lie with a calm certainty no polygraph could ever discover. She loved Steve and hated him. Sometimes they argued over good morning. But life sizzled when they were together and fizzled when they were apart. Right now, one wrong move and they could be apart forever. Tell me again, she said. Everything. Why? I want to see if you tell the same story two times in a row. Aw, come on, Vic. They were sitting in a lawyer's visitation room at the Miami-Dade County Jail. The metal desk and two chairs were bolted to the concrete floor. Victoria hated the place. It smelled of sweat and disinfectant, and something vaguely like cat piss. Her ankle-strap Gucci pumps had slipped on something wet and yellow when she had walked down the corridor. She always felt nauseous visiting a client here. Now that the accused was Steve, she also felt a throat-constricting fear. To get into the jail, she had shown her Florida bar card. To get out, Steve would need a very good lawyer. She had tried and won several murder trials, but with all the emotional baggage, she felt incapable of representing Steve. A surgeon didn't operate on a loved one. If you didn't kill Gorev, who did? She asked. Like I said, Nadia Dolova, our client. Our client? Okay, you were at a hearing in Broward. Nadia was a walk-in. She had $5,000 in cash and said she just needed me for a one-hour meeting. Where's the money? In an envelope, in my desk drawer. When were you going to tell me about it? That reminds me of a lawyer joke. Not now, Steve. A lawyer sends out a bill for $5,000, and the client mistakenly sends him $10,000. What's the ethical question? Obviously, should he return the money? No, should he tell his partner? Steve laughed at his own joke. He had a habit of doing that. A lot of his old habits were starting to irritate her. Accepting new clients without her approval was one. Straddling the border between ethical and sleazy conduct was another. Getting charged with murder was a new one. Where's Nadia now? That's what I need to find out. Or you do. You understand your predicament? The cops found me in a locked room with a dead man and a smoking gun. Yeah, I have a pretty good idea. Tell me everything from the top. Nadia was waiting when I unlocked the door to our office at about 8:15 a.m. She said she was a bar girl, very upfront about it. How admirable. Steve ignored her sarcasm and plowed ahead. She must have come straight from work, because she was all dolled up. Mini dress, heels, jewelry, gloves. Gloves in Miami, in July. Dressy black gloves, up to the elbows, like Holly Golightly in Breakfast at Tiffany's. Wasn't Holly a prostitute? Only in the book. In the movie, she was more like a fun date. Just outside the door, a baby wailed. It was a weirdly discordant sound in this dreadful place. The common visitation area, a dismal space with rows of benches for families, was adjacent to the lawyer's room. The baby's keening reached an impossibly high pitch, and Victoria felt a headache coming on. "Physical description of this, Nadia?" she asked. "About your height, nearly 6 feet, without her heels." She took off her shoes? In the office, for a minute, she rubbed her feet. "Is that important?" "I don't know. Had you ever met this bar girl before?" "Of course not." "But she felt comfortable enough to take off her shoes and rub her feet in your presence?" "Is that a lawyer's question or a girlfriend's question?" "Just keep going. What else besides her height and her tired feet?" "Dark hair, nearly jet black, pale skin and blue eyes. Unusual combination. Very striking." "Well..." He swallowed and his Adam's apple bobbed. Victoria made a mental note that Steve, for all his bluster, might not hold up well under cross-examination. "If you like that sort of thing," he said finally. "I always preferred blondes, like you." "Of course. What else about Nadia can you remember?" "Her lips were very... what's the word?" "I don't know, Steve. What is the word?" "Big?" "Howdy," Victoria said. "Bee stung?" "Yeah, exactly."
That was Bum Rap by Paul Levine. Readers, what's remarkable about this book selection is how the stories focus on the characters' inner struggles and outer realities. I find it a welcome departure from the more static Perry Mason and Miss Marple type adventures. Whatever your preference, check my website, bookreportradio.com, for new titles worth investigating. Thanks so much for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.